That. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's great to see you. Welcome to our very special holiday edition, our super duper special exclusive Purim class. I've titled this class, I'm going to call Purim, you guys ready? I'm going to call it, and I've called it this in two emails, the unholiday. The unholiday. Why do I call it the unholiday? Because as we'll see, the holiday of Purim is different than other holidays. And I know it sounds like a Passover thing, right? Why is this night different than all other nights? But it's different. Purim is different. You should know, and I don't only mean because of the length of the holiday itself. A lot of Jewish holidays have extended time spans. I mean, think about it. Passover is 7-8 days. Shavuot is at least two, you got 2 days here in the diaspora. Rosh Hashanah, again, 2 days here. Yom Kippur, okay, 1 day, but you know what? I don't think anyone's clamoring to fast for 2 days in a row. No one's like, give me 8 days of this Yom Kippur stuff, right? We're not always so excited about extending that one. Sukkot, 8 or 9 days. Diaspora, Israel, diaspora. Chanukah, we have a solid 8 days. So most holidays, you have a chance to settle in and get into it. And you get a second day and a third day, and you really kind of like, you feel it, you get it going. Purim, you know, it arrives, you do it, and then it's like the next day, and then you got stuff to do, and then by the time you, you know, you get into your second or third costume, done. Holiday's over, you can't, it's so quick. Nonetheless, that is not why I'm calling it the unholiday. I'm not calling it the unholiday because it's only 1 day. I'm calling it the unholiday because, as we'll see tonight, the way we observe the holiday is fundamentally different than any other holiday. And to show you what I mean, let's do some word association. Tell me what comes to mind. What mitzvah comes to mind when I say, let's say, for example, Passover? What's a mitzvah that comes to mind?
Eating matzah.
Matzah, good. What comes to mind when we talk about, let's say, Rosh Hashanah?
Honey.
But what mitzvah? That's a custom. What's the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah? What do we have?
Lighting the candles.
Lighting the candles. Good.
Hanukkah.
No, Rosh Hashanah. This is Rosh Hashanah. But you also light holiday candles. Also light candles. We're still lighting candles. That's fine. Well, because what about Rosh Hashanah? What's the mitzvah of Rosh Hashanah? What comes to mind? Shofar, exactly, right? The shofar, the sounding of the shofar. Let's think about Sukkot. What comes to mind? What's the mitzvah that comes to mind?
Eating in the sukkah.
Eating in the sukkah, the astrog and the lulav, exactly. We have very unique mitzvot. And here's the point. And this is the focal point of tonight's class. Look at Purim. What do we do on Purim? So, eat hum and tashin. I want to tell you that although we do that, and although we dress up, it's not a mitzvah. It's a custom. It's a custom. And I know Purim is it is a rabbinic holiday. It's not a biblical holiday, right? Nonetheless, within a rabbinic holiday, you have certain things that are the mitzvah of the rabbinic holiday, and then you have elements that are the custom of the rabbinic holiday. And dressing in costume, and eating hamantashen, etc., those things are the minhagim, those are the customs of Purim. That's not the core observance of Purim. So there are four core mitzvot of Purim. Number one?
Megillah.
Good. Number two? You're on a roll.
Mishloach manot.
Matanot lev yonim. And the mishta. In fact, there's a mnemonic. You know what a mnemonic is? A mnemonic is
to remember.
Yeah, it's a way to remember. They all begin with a letter mem, or M in English. So Megillah, Mishloach Manot, which are the gifts of food to each other, Matanot Levyonim, the charity that we give, and the Mishteh, the Su'udah, but the Mishteh is a feast. Those are the four mitzvot. Let's detail these. I'm going to ask a question soon. I might as well tell you the question. I'll tell you the question now as an introduction, and then we'll build into the question and make it really strong. The core question is going to be, when it comes to other holidays, the mitzvah is a unique mitzvah that you don't find anywhere else. What other holiday has a shofar blast associated with it? What other holiday are you building a hut to sit in, or shaking some leaves, some like botanical items. It doesn't happen, right? What other holiday are you eating flatbread, you know, that's very expensive? Like, it doesn't happen. When it comes to Purim, all four mitzvot are basically, in essence, and I'll explain this in a moment, as we go through it, I'll explain it, they're all replicas of things that we do anyway all year round. We read from scrolls. We are nice to each other and share with each other. We give tzedakah. And we have feasts all the time. Shabbat, holidays. So what's unique about Purim? Let's build into the question. So let's trace all four mitzvot of Purim in the Megillah. Let's begin with text number one on 242. Ray, please get us started. Text number one, 242. This is all a quote from the book of Esther, chapter 9, which details the observances of the holiday.
What makes Purim, Purim? Therefore, the Jewish villagers who live in open towns make the 14th day of the month of Adar a day of joy and feasting, and a festive day, and of sending portions to one another.
So let me just stop you for 1 second. So far we see that there's joy. Okay, but that's a state of mind and state of being. Feasting. So we have the Su'uda, right? It's a day of feasting. Simcha u'mishteh. Mishteh is the feasting. And Mishloach manot ish l're'eyu, sending portions of food, basically, one to another. Continue.
And Mordechai inscribed these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to enjoin them to make the 14th day of the month of Adar and the 15th day thereof every year, as the days when the Jews rested from their enemies and the month that was reversed for them from grief to joy and from mourning to a festive day, to make these days of feasting and joy and sending portions one to another and gifts to the poor.
So one more stop for a second. Look at that last paragraph that Ray just read. What do we have? It's days of joy. It's festive day. Fine, we get that. It's a holiday. But then specifically, it includes feasting and joy. So we have to eat and be happy and send portions of food one to another and gifts to the poor. So here we have, again, 3 out of 4. Only the Megillah here is not mentioned in this specific citation. Continue, please.
And the Jews took upon themselves what they had commenced to do and what Mordechai had written to them. Consequently, these days are recalled and observed in every generation, by every family, every province, and every city. And these days of Purim shall never cease among the Jews, and the memory of them shall never perish among their descendants.
How amazing is that last line, right? Purim is an eternal holiday. You should know the Talmud says, based on this verse, that all of the holidays will be betalin, will be obsolete when Mashiach comes. When the future redemption comes, we're going to need to celebrate the exodus from Egypt. We have a bigger exodus. We have a bigger redemption that we're celebrating, Mashiach. So all the other holidays are going to pale in comparison to the messianic joy and the simcha, the joy of Mashiach. And yet, the Talmud says, the one holiday that we'll still have is Purim. As it says in the Megillah, that Purim will never be made obsolete. Purim will always be remembered and always be celebrated. The one mitzvah of Purim that's not mentioned in these specific verses is the one about reading the Megillah, but it's inferred from other verses in the Megillah. So again, we have here the four mitzvot. Let's take a quick look. Jillian, please read these text. I'll ask you for 2a, 2b, 2c, and 2d. These four texts are going to detail from the code of Jewish law exactly all four mitzvot, the four mems of Purim.
One is obligated to read the Megillah at night and return and repeat it during the day. So even if you go to it at night, you have to go again.
You're supposed to hear it twice, which, by the way, is actually going to play into tonight's discussion, which we'll see soon. But yeah, we're supposed to hear it twice.
It can be read all night while the day reading is all day, from sunrise until the end of the day. If one read it from daybreak, he has fulfilled his obligation.
I love how the Code of Jewish Law kind of like opens this up. It's like, look, you don't need to get it in the first few hours of the night. You know, when it's going to be this Wednesday night. You have all night until the morning. And once the morning starts, for the morning reading, you have from daybreak all day until it gets dark again. So, you know, Purim is a hectic day, so we're giving you a big window of opportunity here. All right, so that's all about the Megillah, twice, night, and during the day. Text 2B, please continue.
One must give at least two gifts to two poor people. Those entrusted with monies donated in honor of Purim may not transfer towards a different charitable cause. One ought not to be discerning with Purim money. Rather, whatever stretches out his hand to ask should be given.
Let me explain this. Text 2B is actually a very important text. So throughout the year, we give tzedakah to various good causes. But on Purim, the mitzvah is specifically, now you can give to whoever, but on Purim, there's a specific additional mitzvah to give to people who are in need. In other words, not necessarily other causes, other good causes, other excellent causes. There are many, many good causes that one can give. In fact, I happen to know a few. But the point is that it's not about giving to a cause on Purim. It's specifically about giving to someone who is in need of that financial help or a meal or whatever it is. So it's giving it to two poor people. That's why the second paragraph of 2B, which you just read.
Do the poor people have to be Jewish? Ideally,
because I think ideally, yes. I think the custom is yes. Although it's still a mitzvah to give to everybody, but I need to double check. Although there are organizations, even local organizations, that especially on Purim, will direct it directly to individuals and families in direct need. In other words, on Purim, it's specifically about person to person, even if it goes to a middle person. But that's why, look at the second paragraph there that you read. It says, those entrusted with monies donated on Purim should not transfer toward a different charitable cause. Don't take that tzedakah money and say, well, we'll put it toward, you know, the yeshiva or the whatever. No. It's a different Purim tzedakah, matana le'avyonim on Purim is supposed to specifically go to individuals who are impoverished. I mean, this is the halacha. This is the specific mitzvah of Purim. And again, it's specifically to two poor people. It doesn't state an amount. It just says to give something to at least two poor people. By the way, I know many have a custom specifically to try to get the money to the poor of Eretz Yisrael, of the Holy Land. There's organizations, including Chabad organizations, that do a lot of good for people, for families in the Holy Land all year round. And on Purim, I specifically, there's a rabbi that I know, and he has a campaign every Purim, and you can donate it online. And he says he makes sure if you do it by a certain amount of time. Oh, actually, sorry, in Purim, in Israel, you have Shushan Purim as well. You have even the next day, and you can fulfill your obligation even the next day. So in the diaspora here in America, in Atlanta, at any time throughout Purim, if you donate, you can donate online. It's easy. And he makes sure that it's going to go directly to the poor, a poor family, poor individuals in Eretz Yisrael, in the Holy Land. And it's 100% fulfilling the obligation in an ideal way. And again, it's not like you need to, yeah, it's not a struggle to find. It's an easy way. Not like we're looking for an easy way to do it, but it's a manageable way to do it. And you fulfill the obligation. By the way, I'm not saying not to give to local poor. I'm saying if someone's looking specifically for the Israel angle, so there's definitely opportunities for that as well. Okay, so now we have the Megillah and the gifts to the poor. Please, if you don't mind, continue to see.
One should add a festive meal on Purim. This obligation is met with one meal. Making a Purim meal at night does not fulfill this obligation. Nevertheless, one should be happy and add more during his meal, even at night.
So the Code of Jewish Law says, have a festive meal, but when? The night of Purim or the day of Purim? And clearly text 2C says, it's the daytime that we're supposed to have the meal. So again, practically this year, so Purim begins Wednesday night, and we have a Megillah reading here, I think starting at what? 7:15 are some opening festivities. Megillah is about 8:15, because you have to wait till after nightfall. Whatever, so it's somewhere 7, 8 o'clock Wednesday night. We'll have some food, but the main su'uda, the main feast, is meant to happen on Thursday. It says you can also have food the night of Purim, but the main thing is the one meal during the day. Finally, text 2D, last one.
One must send to his fellow two portions of meat or foodstuffs, as the verse states, and of sending portions to one another. Two portions to one man is the obligation. And anyone who sends more to his fellows is praiseworthy.
So this is the Mishloach Manot, and this is probably, I would say, the one mitzvah. Well, no, Megillah is pretty big. Whatever, but this is the one where you go out and you deliver food packages to friends. And again, the core mitzvah is two types of foods to at least one person. The custom is men should give to men, women to women. Yeah, you can give also men to women. I mean, you could give, but the main custom, the original custom is that men to men and women to women for modesty purposes, etc. But the point is at least two portions of food to one recipient. You can give more than two foods to one person. You can give more packages to more people, but that's the core obligation. Now, I should also mention, the custom of the Mishloach Manot is to give two types of foods that have two different brachot, two different blessings. So like a hamantashen is the blessing of mezonot, and a little kedem grape juice bottle is the hagafen. So you have two different blessings. Or you can go, you know, some fruit and some pastry, whatever it is. But the idea is to have two different types of foods, not like two of the same, two different types of foods, and at least to one person. So now we have the four mitzvot. By the way, look at the Code of Jewish Law. It doesn't talk about dressing up. There's no mention of, and don't forget, do all of this in your favorite Batman costume. It doesn't say that. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't do that. It's a nice custom. It's a custom that has its own significance, its own message of, on Purim, we recognize that when we look at someone, you know, they're not actually Batman or Spider-Man or Superman or Darth Vader or, I don't know, whoever it is, right? The person beneath the mask. So too on Purim, the story of Purim, there's a story that happens on the outside, but then there's a truth that happens on the inside. So look a little bit deeper. Just like we look at the other person deeper, we can look at the story deeper and look at the world in a deeper way. Fine. But nonetheless, it's not an obligation. The four obligations are the Megillah, tzedak, the matanot le'avyonim, the gifts to the poor, the gifts of food to a friend, and the festive meal and the gifts of food to the friend. And once again, the four in Hebrew are Megillah, Mikra Megillah, Mishloach Manot, Matanot Levyonim, and Mishta. And our,
excuse me, interrupting. Aren't there also obligations at the Seuda? Like you start it when it's light out, it ends when it's dark.
Yeah.
You light candles and don't say the bracha. And you drink until you don't know the difference.
Yeah.
Between Mordechai and Haman.
Those would be customs within that mitzvah. Those are not obligatory, although the Talmud says, Chayiv Adam, Libesumi Bepuri Adaliyada, it says that a person is obligated to drink until they don't know. So the question is the drinking on that level, or whatever it means, because there's different ways to fulfill it, is it an obligation like the feast itself? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it rises to the same level, but you're right, there are traditions associated with the feast. We definitely want to start the feast on the day of Purim before nightfall. Because once it hits nightfall, the day's over. So it's after Purim. So you definitely want to start the meal by washing your hands for bread before nightfall. And then you can continue and you can extend it as long as you want. But you have to you're supposed to start the meal at least before that, at any point during the day. And then, you're supposed to... Look, the original, the Talmudic... language is a person should drink until they don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. So, but again, there's a lot of discussion about exactly what that means and why that is, but that's not today's class. As far as lighting candles, I've seen different traditions on that, but again, it's more of a custom than a core obligation. Okay, now, the question we're going to ask, and I mentioned this before, but let's try to strengthen the question. The question is, it seems like when it comes to the obligations of Purim, there's nothing special. Reading the story of Purim from a scroll is something we do. Okay, it's not exactly the same, but we read scrolls all the time. Every Shabbat morning, we read a scroll. When there's a regular minyan in a synagogue community that has regular services throughout the week, you read the Torah Shabbat morning, Shabbat afternoon, Monday morning, and Thursday morning, four times a week. So to pull out a scroll and read the book of Esther, it's not as unusual as pulling out a ram's horn and sounding the shofar. Rosh Hashanah is getting something unique. Sukkot, you're taking a palm branch and an esrog and doing the shake, that's once a year. I mean, there's nothing else that's like that. But pulling out a scroll and reading it is not fundamentally new and novel. It's a twist, but it's a twist of an old favorite. So that's point number one. Okay, point number two, when we talk about giving gifts of food to friends, so the reality is that we're always meant to extend food, to be hospitable and give people food, etc. It's about unity, it's about bringing people together. But it's not fundamentally foreign to the Jewish way of life. Now, maybe there's no obligation otherwise to give gifts of food to others. But nonetheless, it doesn't seem to be something so super novel where it stands alone as a unique element of the holiday of Purim. It doesn't seem to be so special and exclusive and unique. It just simply doesn't have that feel to it. Take a look at text number four. Text number four is a commentary called Manot HaLevi on the book of Esther. And here he cites the idea of giving gifts of food as being all about camaraderie and fellowship and friendship, which again are perennial all year round Jewish ideals. Text number four, Howard, please read.
The village of dwellers went further than the inhabitants of Shushan in initiating the practice of Mishloach Manot, symbolizing that they had joined together in love and fraternity the opposite of their oppressor, Haman's statement that they were scattered and divided. The added practice of Mishloach Manot and Matanot, Levanim, show that they were of one heart and in a state of brotherhood. Mordechai assented to the practice of Mishloach Manot, for it was through friendship and brotherhood that they were saved and not through division.
So the whole point of Haman was there's a nation that's separate and everyone's doing their own thing, etc. And the antidote to that is camaraderie, giving gifts of food to each other and in a state of brotherhood and sisterhood and Jewish unity. And wonderful, that's a great thing, and that's a great Purim theme, and it's an antidote to Haman's challenge and claim against the Jewish people. But at the end of the day, the theme of camaraderie is a perennial theme. Ahavat Yisrael, to love a fellow Jew, is something that's timeless. Again, there's no equivalent of blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. It's not like throughout the year we're supposed to anyway sound instruments, but on Rosh Hashanah it's a ram's horn. That's not the case. It's a totally novel idea. It's like throughout the year we're supposed to wave other types of plants. On Sukkot, it's the lulav and the esrog. No, we don't wave any plants. But the idea of hospitality, bring people into your home, or sending gifts of food, we always do that. Someone has a baby, so, right? Mazel tov. The next thing you know, there's a group. Meals, let's cook meals, let's give food. It's giving food and inviting people over for food. It's something that's done. It's not something that's so unusual. So the question again is, Purim doesn't seem to be so unique. Now let's talk about text 5. Text 5 is a quick one. Sharna, please read text 5, 248.
The verse states, you should love your fellow as yourself, Rabbi Akiva said. This is a basic principle of the Torah.
There you go. So loving your fellows yourself is a fundamental idea that's not exclusive to Purim. Hence the question, what's going on? Now, let's talk about the third mitzvah of Purim, which is giving gifts of money to the poor, giving at least two poor people money. What do we call that? Tzedakah. So on Purim, we have a new name, a mem name, Matanot Le'evyonim, gifts to the poor. And we call that the rest of the year Tzedakah. We're always supposed to give tzedakah. Now, I know I said before that the rest of the year you can give tzedakah to an organization, not necessarily to an impoverished individual who's going to use it for their immediate needs. Fine. It's a little bit different. Nonetheless, fundamentally, at its core, it's nothing new. It's not exclusive to Purim. The notion of giving the poor something to use to purchase what they need, that's not something unique to Purim. And finally, the last element, the fourth mitzvah, is the feast. Like I said before, and I'll say it again, having a feast, having a Jewish feast, having a holiday feast is certainly not unique and novel to Purim. We have feasts every Shabbat, every holiday except for Yom Kippur. There's always feasts going on, Jewish feasts with different types of foods, etc. It doesn't seem to be a unique thing to Purim. And so the question is, when it comes to all four mitzvot of Purim, we have the same core issue, the same core problem, the same core question. How is this uniquely Purim? Reading scrolls, done. We always do that. Giving people food, we always do that. Giving tzedakah, we always do that. Having meals, lavish meals, we always do that. So what's Purim? Suddenly, what seems to be an interesting and unique holiday, when you really look at it, other than the dressing up and the hamantashen, which again are not mitzvot, they're customs. But in the mitzvot themselves, Purim seems to be not so exclusive or not so unique, not so distinctive on its own. In other words, it seems to be more of the same. And in fact, the commentaries discuss this. The commentaries...
You don't have to dress up then on Purim.
You don't have to.
But you will look odd if you don't.
Yeah. I always tell people I'm dressed up as a rabbi. So you don't have to. You don't have to. You don't have... No, it's not an obligation. You're supposed to listen to the Megillah and have a meal and give tzedakah and give... And food to friends, but it doesn't say anywhere in Halach, in the Code of Jewish Law, that you have to dress up. So the commentaries that address this, they point out that yes, the question is true. In other words, the answer is not going to be no. There's something different. No, it's actually, you're right. The question is a valid question, and the question stands. In other words, on Purim, we don't do anything new. When I say new, we don't do anything that's totally out of the box in an obligatory sense. What we do, though, is we take things that we ordinarily do and we ratchet it up a few notches. In other words, it's stuff that you would do throughout the year, but on Purim, you do it even more. Let's go through them one by one. The Megillah. How many times do we listen to the Megillah? Twice. Once at night and once during the day. That is not usual. We don't usually do that. In other words, we usually read, for example, we read... Okay, look at it this way. The only holiday that we have a scroll and we read it at night is Purim. I think maybe some people have a custom on Simchat Torah to read the Torah at night. Chabad doesn't have the custom. We just dance with it.
Don't they read the end and the beginning?
So we do that during the day. I know Chabad certainly does it during the day. I'm not sure if others do it at night as well. But I'll tell you, the Torah readings, Monday morning, Thursday morning, Shabbat afternoon, but before dark. The Megillah is unique. You read it after nightfall, Wednesday night. It's going to be dark outside. We pull out the scroll and we read a Megillah. And then we read the whole thing again the next day. So we read the whole thing twice, night and day, and that is unique. So although reading from a scroll is not unique, but reading twice from the same scroll, back to back, night and day, that is unique.
When you do Eicha.
Eicha, yeah, but Eicha you don't, good. But Eicha you don't read from a scroll. Eicha, you just read from a booklet. So this is from a scroll, but you are right. And Eicha also, we don't read it during the day. Some have accustomed to recite it quietly to themselves during the day after they do the long, the kinos, the long whatever is prayers. but it's not formally recited and sung, at least in Chabad synagogues. It's only done at night. So it's kind of like the night, not the day, or the day, not the night. This is twice, back to back. And the full thing from a full scroll. So it's stuff that we do in other contexts, but it's amped up. And let's talk about the next thing, giving gifts of food. We always give gifts of food, but in a conscious way, in a way that we drive around and deliver them and package them up and give good food to multiple people. Again, that type of focus, that type of singular focus, it's amped up, it's ratcheted up on Purim. And giving gifts of money to the poor, we always give, we're always supposed to give tzedakah, but again, focusing specifically on giving to the poor and giving them, by the way, halacha says that you're supposed to give the person. You know, he used the example in the Code of Jewish Law. Do you notice? He said giving, what did he say? What type of food? What did he say?
Two foods.
He said portions, two portions of meat or food stuffs. What's food stuffs? What does it mean, meat or food stuffs? You know what it means? It means you're supposed to give ready-to-eat food. Don't give a box of pancake mix. I don't know why that came to mind. It's the most random thing I could have thought of. Don't give a box of pancake mix or Duncan Hines brownie mix. I'm trying to think of things that you would need multiple steps to make. Or Manischewitz potato kugel mix. Although, I don't know if I would recommend that in general. No, okay, because I'm a huge potato kugel guy. So, you know, that's just me being potato kugely. But don't give something that requires a recipient to go ahead, right, and make the food. Give food. I'm sorry, this is still the Mishloach Manot. This is not the Tzedakah. This is the Mishloach Manot. I may have merged into the next one. But so the food that you give is supposed to be food that's ready to go. And the Tzedakah that you give is supposed to go directly to the poor who need it right now, that they can purchase what they need. And the festive meal, we mentioned before, you're supposed to intoxicate, you're supposed to imbibe until you don't know the difference between Haman and Mordechai. And it also says in the Code of Jewish Law that the simcha, the joy of the festive meal, is unparalleled. It's supposed to be off the charts. So what we see here is that, yes, there's nothing new on Purim. But what you do with the existing, with things that you would do in other contexts, on Purim, you amp it up. It's like if you have a dial, right, and it's usually like here or here, so you crank it up, and it's like, you know, past the needle, or the needle is past, you know, in the red zone, or whatever it is, it's 100%.
But you can give money instead of food, right, to the poor.
Yes, yes, yeah, I misspoke. The food, the ready-to-eat food is the gifts of food to a friend. It's supposed to be ready to go. To the poor, it's also supposed to be funds that are ready to purchase immediately and not like sitting somewhere and holding it somewhere or whatever. And also, I should mention, there's also the idea that we're supposed to be proactive in seeking out those to give. Whereas the rest of the year, if someone asks, you give. On Purim, we are proactive to look out, to seek out those who could use some extra help. So on Purim, again, it's stuff that we do always, but it's much more focused and we're more conscious about it and we do it to a much greater degree, a much greater intensity. And so herein lies really the power of Purim, which we're going to develop now over the second half of the class. In other words, what is Purim based on all of this? Purim is not a time that celebrates something brand new or totally out of the box and totally different than another holiday or than Judaism in general. What it is, it's about a depth and a passion within what you're already doing. It's about bringing an extra energy, an extra passion, an extra degree of dedication to what's ordinarily and normally there. That's the soul of Purim. That's why I said Purim is the unholiday. Every holiday has, look at me, I'm different. Purim is not different. Purim is deeper. It's Judaism, but on a much deeper, more focused, more mindful way. Why? It all goes back to the core theme of Purim. And what's going to help us get there are a few texts. Let's begin with text number six. Text number six. David, please read text six. This comes from the Halachot Gedolot.
The The day of Purim is as great as the day on which the Torah was given.
Very interesting. Here, the Baal Halachot Gedolot, the author of the Halachot Gedolot, he compares Purim to the day that the Torah was given. The obvious question is, why? Why is he comparing Purim to the day the Torah was given? Like, what's the essential connection? All of this, that statement, is based on a Talmudic statement, text number seven is going to answer this question of what's the connection between Purim and Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Marnin? Text 7, page 250.
The verse states, and they stood under the mount, Rabbi Abdimi ben Hamad ben Hasa said, this teaches that the Holy One, blessed be He, overturned the mountain upon them like an inverted cast, and said to them, if you accept the Torah, all is well. If not, there shall be your burial. Rabbi Ahab ben Jacob observed, this furnishes a strong protest against the Torah. Said Rabbi, yet even so they reaccepted it in the days of Ahasuerus. For it is written, the Jews confirmed and took upon them, etc. They confirmed what they had accepted long before.
So let me explain this. Let me explain the Talmud. The Talmud quotes a verse from the book of Exodus. And the book of Exodus, in the story of Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai for the very first time, or the only time, right? The Torah says that the Jewish people stood tachat hahar. Vayisatzvu betachtit hahar. They stood at, it's translated typically at the foot of the mountain. But literally in Hebrew, they stood under the mountain. What does it mean they stood under the mountain? So the Talmud says, quotes Rav Avdimi, and he says, Hashem picked up the mountain, Mount Sinai, held it over their heads, and said, if you accept Torah, fantastic. If not, you're done. I will bury you here. Immediately, what did the Jews say? Yeah, we're in, right? There's no other option. So comes along the Talmud, Rabbi Acha ben Yaakov, and he says, Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov says, this gives a protest against Torah. Moda'a rabba lo raita. This is a protest. It's a, what's a good word for it? Protest, but it's a...
He's accepted under duress.
Yeah, it's basically there wasn't consent, right? We talk about consent in relationships, right? There was no consent in this relationship. God threatens the Jewish people. He holds a mountain over their heads. Yeah, you'll take it? You'll accept it? Yeah. Okay, mazel tov. So what's going on? So that you call that acceptance? They accepted it? They said yes? Yeah, they said yes. Did they really say yes? How do you know? Without consent, was their yes consensual? Did they say yes freely and truly, or did they say yes under duress? It seems. Before that. So they had said yes, which begs the question, so why did God lift the mountain over their heads? Okay, that's another question. But at this point in time, when God lifts the mountain over their heads, why he did it, I don't know. But that act of doing it, in essence, creates a claim against Torah's validity. In other words, the Jew could say, theoretically, remember when we said yes to Torah and we obligated ourselves to follow all these precepts? You should know, when we said yes, we signed that contract under duress. So you know what? At this point, we'd rather opt out. Theoretically, the Jews could have done that, on a theoretical sense. So that's why. So comes along Rabbah, and he says, you should know, although that's true, or Rabbah says, although that's true, that at Sinai, they didn't fully consent to Torah, given the mountain over their heads. Nonetheless, when did the Jewish people as a whole formally consent with their full free will to accept the Torah and all of its obligations? In the times of Ahasuerus. And it says that's what the Megillah means when it says Kimu v'kiblu ayudim, they accepted, they confirmed and took it upon themselves, which means in the Talmudic understanding, they confirmed what they had already said yes to. They had said yes to Torah at Sinai, but that yes was under duress. During the times of the Purim story, they confirmed that that yes was a real yes, and it came truly and freely and purely without any duress. Now, there's a lot of questions that we have on this statement. What was going on at Sinai? What was the mountain? Did God literally pick up the mountain? What was going on? Why was there a mountain being picked up? Etc. So take a look at Tosfot. Tosfot text 8 asks the question, and really he asks Ray's question. So Ray, you could have basically authored the Tosfot text 8. As you'll see, this is your question. David, please read.
He overturned the mountain upon them like an inverted cask. Why would this be necessary if the Jews already accepted the Torah by saying, we will do and we will obey?
Tosfot asks, so God is forcing the Jewish people into it. Why? They had already said yes. Why is it? What's with the coercion here? So because of this question and because of other questions, so the Kabbalists, the mystics, including the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, have a completely different understanding of this mountain over the heads. The mountain is not a physical mountain. And the mountain was not a threat or something scary where God is saying, I'm going to kill you and destroy you if you don't receive the Torah. That's not what happened. The mountain is symbolic, is a metaphor for love. Why love? Because love is an emotion that's very big, like a mountain, right? You have a landscape, and then you have in the middle of your landscape, you have this big mountain. So on an emotional landscape, love is very big. And so when the Talmud says that God lifted Mount Sinai, suspended the mountain over their heads and said, will you accept it? If not, I'll drop it. You know what it means? Based on Kabbalah, based on Hasidic philosophy. It means that God was so in love with the Jewish people and demonstrated that love to us that when he asked, will you receive the Torah? We couldn't say no. You know, when somebody loves you so much and does so much for you, you have to reciprocate with love. You're almost forced into it, right? Somebody loves you unconditionally in an immense way, in an intense way. It's really hard to assess your own feelings toward them. Do you really love them or do you love the fact that they love you? And so the same thing was happening according to Hasidic philosophy at Mount Sinai. God's love was like a mountain. And that was the overwhelming force when the Jews stood at Sinai and God says, do you want the Torah? And we said, of course we want the Torah. It wasn't necessarily because we wanted the Torah. We didn't really think about it too much. We said yes because of how much God was expressing his love for us. Let me read this inside text number 9, 251 or 252, I'm not sure. This is why God overturned the mountain upon them like a cask. As in the verse, his right hand embraces me, it implies a degree of expression of God's supernal love for the Jewish people. This love embraces the collective Jewish people, just like when one hugs another person, surrounding him from all sides, even the back, so that he cannot move away and is compelled to stand there facing him. When you hug someone tight, you know what you're doing? You're expressing your love, and they can't move, right? You give someone a bear hug, it's wonderful, but they can't get out of it necessarily. God gave us a hug, such a hug that we couldn't say no. You want the Torah? Of course. God was embracing us. How could you say no? In other words, because of God's supernal love, a love awakened within the souls of the Jewish people, uplifting them to the point where they would declare, we will do and we will obey. Anyway, that's the point. That is the point. Let's do the last paragraph. Let's skip. This is the meaning of overturning of the mountain. It suggests the supernal love, which is referred to as a mountain. It is likened to a cask, which suggests something that surrounds and overwhelms all worlds, a light so intense that it awakens a love within them. In other words, God revealed his love for the Jewish people, and we couldn't help but respond with saying yes. Again, when you talk about consent, and this has become a national conversation in the last few years, when you talk about consent in various forms and various relationships, when someone has a certain influence over the other, even if the other one says yes, and they're not being forced, there's no gun to the head, but even if it's from a positive place, it might not be 100% consensual because it's coming from some sort of place of coercion, even if it's a positive coercion.
As you were describing that, I was thinking that maybe that's not really literal. That when the mountain over the head was, the guy just reflected back what the truth was, that they had somehow darkness had clouded, a cloud had come over the Jewish people, and that wasn't a literal. Right, when the truth is laid on you that heavily,
you can't do anything else. You're forced into it. Yeah,
you know, because it's just reminding you of the deal.
Of the deal, 100%. That's exactly what the other Rebbe says. He says it's not necessarily a mountain. Remember. The Torah doesn't say that God lifted a mountain. The Talmud says this. And a Talmudic statement could be understood in a non-literal fashion. The Torah, we have a teaching Torah, always needs to be understood as well on a little. Now, you can understand Torah as also metaphor, and certainly Kabbalah does that, but Torah always also has a literal meaning as well. Ein mikra yotze midei pshuto. No verse can truly depart from its simple meaning as well. But when it comes to the Talmud and the Midrash, Some of the teachings of the Talmud and the Midrash are metaphoric, and the Alter Rebbe says that this, I can't say that he says for sure it didn't happen literally, but it seems like his implication is that it was more about the love and less about an actual mountain. And given the state of God's love, that moment, you know, people make decisions in certain moments that later on they rethink, right? You were caught up, it was in the moment, and you decided, you know, let me do this. And later on, you're like, I was swept up a little bit in the moment. The Jews were swept up in the moment. They were all gathered. God revealed his love. He said, you want the Torah? We said, yeah, of course. Yeah, we love you. Maybe later on, you know, once that wears off, we're like, well, wait a second. Hold on. What do we just do? What do we just commit to? This is a long-term eternal deal. There's 613 mitzvot. And a lot of sub-details, this is a big obligation. So the point is that the Talmud's overall overarching point still stands, that when the Jews said yes at Sinai, although they said yes, there was a little bit of coercion there on some level. When did they truly say yes from within without any external force? It was in the times of Purim, the Purim story. Why? Why is this? We're going to skip text 10, and we're going to skip text 11a, and we're going to skip text 11b, and we're going to talk about, we'll continue soon with 11c, but we'll get there soon. But here's my point. When did the Jewish people, on their own, say to God, you know what, we're in it, on our own accord? That happened in the times of Purim. Why? Let me explain. The times of Purim, nothing was going right for the Jewish people. There was no mountain of love. There really wasn't. Haman had put forth a decree that had leaked. It had gone, you know, someone found it, took a picture and sent it on WhatsApp. It got out there, Facebook or Instagram. It was out there. It was known that Haman had, and Ahasuerus had rubber stamped it. 13th of Adar, God forbid, wiping out the entire Jewish people, man, woman, and child, one day. This was a bad deal. Bad news. It was also known that Haman's decree was not like Germany 1930s. It wasn't a biological deal. It wasn't like anyone who genetically was Jewish had to be killed. That, God forbid, that wasn't the deal. Haman said, if you act like a Jew, I'm going to take you out. We're going to take you out. But as the Alter Rebbe clarifies, any Jew who, oh, and by the way, one more thing before I continue that. The decree, Haman had this plan for a year out. It was 12 months. The story, you read the Megillah, it takes 20, 30 minutes. Everything, time is compressed. From when Haman first rolls the dice chooses the day, sends out the letter, to when the day comes and the Jews defend themselves and achieve victory, it's about 12 months, about a full year. At any time during that year, if a Jew or the Jews collectively would have said, you know what, Haman, here's the deal. You know, we're not so into this whole Judaism thing, God forbid. And you know what? We'll become Persian. We'll become like you. Haman would have said, no problem, you're safe. You're safe. Haman only wanted to kill, God forbid, Jews who looked like Jews, not Jews who were Persians. Therefore, again, he wasn't, this is before science and biology. This wasn't Germany 1930s. This wasn't Hitler, Yamashimai, who didn't care how you acted. It was all about a biological, right? It was all scientific, right? Haman, if you were Yehudi, if you were a God-fearing Jew, he wanted to destroy you, God forbid. The Jews stood, and according to our tradition, not one member of the Jewish people defected. Not one. They stood with mesirat nefesh, they stood with self-sacrifice, to not abandon their ways, their faith, to not give up their Judaism, to not in any way weaken their Jewish observance, and they stood in that state of sacrifice, of dedication, for a full year. It wasn't like a moment of life or death, you know, where a person makes a brave choice and a heroic choice and becomes a martyr in one moment. It was a sustained action of a full year to stand at Mesirat Nefesh for 12 months, a full 12 months, to not give one inch. That's dedication. For somebody to be brave one time and say, I will never give up my Judaism, no matter what it takes, God forbid, and that's it. I'm not taking away from that bravery and from that act, but it's one choice. To make a choice every single day to be a Jew, to act like a Jew, to study Torah and do mitzvot, even with that threat hanging over a person's head every single day for 12 months, that was incredible. And you know what that was according to the Talmud? That was the Jews telling God, yes, we're in this from our own choice. Because if the Jews ever wanted to opt out, this was a fantastic time. At Sinai, God overwhelmed them with love. How could they say no? This times of Purim, there was no love. Well, who am I to say there was no love? You couldn't feel the love. Where's God's love? There's a threat. There's an anti-Semite like Haman who's threatening to kill us all in one day, God forbid. Where's God's love now? Now, at the end, it worked out. But that doesn't change the fact that for 12 months, collectively, the Jewish people said every single day, we're in it. We choose it. We say yes. Not because we're being forced into it. On the contrary, we're being pushed out of it. They still opted in. So it turns out, what happened on Purim? Here's what happened. On Purim, the Jewish people, again, this has happened before throughout the whole year, but Purim represents the moment in time when the Jewish people looked inward and said, you know, all the stuff that we're doing, all this Jewish stuff, you know what? We actually really mean it. We're really dedicated to it. We're not just doing it because it's convenient and easy. We're doing it even when it's not convenient and even when it's not easy. And even if it might get us into severe trouble, we're still going to do it. And that's why Purim is, in a sense, the culmination and, according in one way of understanding it, greater than Sinai. At Sinai, we chose it. It was the easy way out. On Purim, we chose it when it was the hard way out. And we still chose it. And so that's why, how do we observe Purim? You know how? We don't do anything new. We just re-choose what we've already done. We read Torah, we read scrolls, even more than before. We give tzedakah, even more than usual. We give gifts of food to others, even more. We have a meal, and we go all out. In others, we do the same Jewish things, but from a place of inner conviction and inner strength that then affects what we're doing to amp it up in a much greater degree. So Purim is not a time to do something new and novel. Purim is a time to do what we're already doing Jewishly, but do it in a much deeper way. Let's read some texts. Let's take a look. I'll read these texts. Let's read just a few texts. 11C. 11C. Just to back up what I said before, 11C255, the Alter Rebbe writes, the founder of Chabad writes in Torah R, had they apostatized, God forbid, you know what that means, apostatize? It sounds like they made some pasta. No, apostatize means, had they given up their Jewish identities, nothing would have happened to them, for the decree only applied to Jews. And again, it's not biological, it's card-carrying. Nevertheless, not one of them even entertained an outside thought of machshavat chutz, God forbid, and instead sacrificed their lives for God. In other words, they were ready to sacrifice their lives for God every single day. Let's continue with the other texts about this. Text 12a. Oh, look at this one. Text 12a. The Rebbe explains, 258. Look at this. This is beautiful. The difference between doing something under duress and doing something willingly and consciously is this. When someone is being forced, he or she will only do as much as they have to fulfill their obligation. However, when a person acts of their own volition and desire, they do not suffice with simply meeting their obligation. Rather, they strive and search for ways to add and enhance the act more than is demanded of them out of duty. If you have a job and you're told you have to, and you don't want to do it, you really don't want to do it, but you're told you have to, you know what you'll do? You'll do exactly the parameters of the job. But when you're passionate about it, when you're excited about it, you're going to go above and beyond. When the Jews accepted Torah at Sinai under duress, so they were only going to do what they had to do. Times of Purim, when they accepted it on their own, now it's much deeper and much stronger. Text 12b, let's continue. The Rebbe continues to explain. This is expressed through the mitzvot of Mikra Megillah, Mishloach Manot, and Maratonot Levyonim to explain. On the one hand, these three things aren't entirely new. But on the other hand, they are enhanced. They are each enhanced in some way relative to before. The concept of reading the Megillah isn't at all novel, right? We read scrolls all the time. Nevertheless, we have an additional public reading at night from a scroll of parchment, and so on. Mishloach Manot, the mitzvah of Avos Yisrael does not mandate us to search for another to fulfill the commandment to love your fellows yourself. However, the mitzvah of sending gifts from one person to his friend is novel in that in doing so, we work to find a friend. And by sending him a gift, we put loving your fellows yourself into practice. In other words, we proactively seek to extend food to someone else. Matan Levyonim, gifts to the poor. While the mitzvah of tzedakah applies year-round, the charity we perform on Purim is superior in that it isn't enough to perform the mitzvah upon encountering a poor person. Rather, one must go seek out two poor people and give them charity. In other words, text 12c, let's continue. We're just going to read the rest of the text. This is emphasized in the words of the Talmud. They confirmed what they had accepted long before. These are things that we already accepted. We are already obligated in them and do them regardless. In other words, we read Torah from scrolls. We give food when necessary. We give tzedakah when necessary. We have festive meals. All of that is done before. On Purim, however, they receive additional confirmation. They achieve a degree of validation and strength. A person says, you know what? I'm not just doing it because I have to. I'm doing it because I want to. And because I want to, I'll be proactive. I'll seek out. I'll give more than I usually give, etc., etc., etc. So what's the point? The point is like this. We're not going to do the last two texts. The point is like this. On Purim, Purim is a day in which our Jewishness is meant to be enhanced. It's a day in which we reflect on not just what we're obligated to do, but how much we want to do it. And how much we want to do it even when it's difficult. And that's the theme, that's the energy, that's the motif, if you will. That's the whole point of Purim. Purim is, today, we choose it on our own. And because we choose it, we love it. And because we love it, we're going to do it better than ever. And therefore, we read extra scrolls, and we have extra food, and extra l'chaims, and extra everything. Extra tzedakah, and extra gifts to friends. We go above and beyond. It's not new. But it's much deeper. My blessing to us all is that, number one, this Purim should be a joyous and festive day. And we should gather together. We have opportunities here both Wednesday night and Thursday to gather and celebrate together. So number one, we should do the mitzvot. And we should do it together as friends and community. That's number one. And number two, in our own personal lives, We should think about, we should take to heart this these themes, or this theme. And at some point during the 24 hours of Purim, resolve in our hearts to own our Jewishness and to make it something, to move it beyond something we have to do and move it into the realm of things that we want to do. And when we want to do it, it's going to be a totally different ballgame. It's maybe the same, it may look the same, same-ish, but it's going to be a totally different experience. May all of our Purim celebrations and experiences be transformative from the inside out. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for a special edition of Purim Torah Study. Thank you.